Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel. Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Don't go away. Yes, you're in the right place. No, no, no. Don't turn... Keep coming here. There you go. Another show of The Suspendables happening right now with, of course, Russ Cortinel. And we get inside Russ's head this week. He gives us some secrets about how he's going to tackle these playoffs, what coaches have to do, what it's like to be a GM now compared to the day Russ played. And it's totally different. Also, what happens if you miss practice? Great practical joke. They play on guys when they're late for practice. I absolutely loved it. And a player who showed up drunk when Russ was playing with him on the team. How about this? Russ had to be interviewed by these teams who were going to pick him up. And not just a really weird interview, almost like a psychologist. Could you imagine trying to break things down that Russ is thinking? You're going to find out that and much, much more coming up on today's show. Rolling, rolling, rolling. Keep this machine a-rolling. Rusty, my boy, how are you? Welcome to another show, everyone, of The Suspendables. With me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and him, Russ Cortinel.
Mm-hmm.
Another week in the books, Rusty. How was it?
It was good. Had a great week. Had my family here till Tuesday, and Lawton leaves tomorrow. So
saw that.
Great few days with everybody.
How do you stuff them all in there? Because I know you're sort of fly at bachelor wise when you're there. And you got to go rent a couple more motorhomes or what?
No. We managed.
Okay.
We had to get her a blow up coat or a blow up mattress, but you know, we all squeezed in here. It was great.
Yeah. And they know they're getting the mattress. The kids know that.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. They're not getting a bed here. Yeah.
Well, you know, and the kids are, well, Eric and Allie are in one room, Lawton and Zoe are in another, and mom and dad are in, and I'm just, you know, praying I sleep through the night and wear earmuffs to bed.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when all the kids are on, that's cool, you know. I got a birthday, my kid's 21, so I got a birthday tonight with him, you know, and they're... They become more special, right, as your kids get older, because you just see them less and less, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when we do get together, I'm completely frustrated with them right away. For example, like when we get together to watch Russ, Big Daddy gets the fucking remote here, okay?
Oh.
Okay? I get the remote. Make it very clear. And what I did, Russ, is they'll snatch it up from me, right, when I'm not looking.
Right.
I got the backup remote so I can override them. I got two of them. Who gets it in your family?
Fuck. I don't watch a lot of TV, so it doesn't bother me. They can watch whatever they want.
What do you do if you're not watching TV these days?
I get my information off the phone, and I'm just... I've said before, when this whole COVID thing hit, I just, after a week of watching shitty news every day, I said, tell me when it's over.
Yeah, right. So, right. Yeah, I agree. On today's show, playoffs are going ahead. Camps open this week. The first, they're going to roll it out August 1st, the first games. We're going to talk about that. I want to ask you about some of the coaches who were ran the toughest practices, what they did when guys slacked off. You've always got great stories there about it. GMs running hockey teams, Russ. Is it different today than what it was when you were around, how they got to run a team, what they're looking for? And I thought I'd ask you, Russ, about, because you one of the cool things about you is how connected you stayed with all the guys you used to play with. And I love that about the NHL. And I wanted to, some of the post-career stories are really good. There's some sad ones, but there's some great success stories of guys and business and stuff, what they did post-career. Anyway, that and a lot more. So what do you think, Rusty? The playoffs are here. There's 24 teams who are going to start it. They got a play-in. They got a play-in round. The top four teams in each conference are going to do a round robin. The other 16 teams are going to play best of fives. I read a stat, Rusty, the other day that best of fives haven't been around in a long time, many years. Steve, you'll throw that stat up for me. I think it's I don't know how far back it goes, but the most significant thing I read, Russ, was the teams that won the first game in a best of five series went on to win the series.
Really?
Like 100% of them. So put your coaching hat on here, Russ. 4 months off. We got to launch into this thing. I don't know how the shape players are going to be in. You know, back in your day, Russ, I guess, you know, did a team change anything? So, you know, you finish the regular season and 2 days later you got to drop the puck for the playoffs. Did much change, Russ, from regular season into playoffs when you were around?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah. Totally different game. The lineup changes and maybe not so much today, but when I played, the tough guys usually didn't play in the playoffs, the fighters, because they were, you know, potentially going to risk a 5 minute penalty or, you know, getting a scrap, and the fighting really stopped once you hit the playoffs. But I played in 86 in a best of five against Chicago, and we were the worst team. We had the worst record to make the playoffs, and we played against Chicago, who had, I think that year, the second best record to Edmonton, and we swept them in three games. So the stat is true. You win the first game, you can win, and it was such an upset. I think Denny Savard might have been second to scoring that year to Gretz. But wow, we went into Chicago. We won the first two games. They obviously took us lightly, and then came back to Toronto and we beat them, and we kicked their ass. And Denny Savard's comments after were just, you know, that's the worst team. We shooting them, you know, freaking, they're awful, and how embarrassing. And then in the next series, that was, so the first round was best of five, and then it went best of seven. All the way to the finals,
right?
And we lost in seven games to St. Louis. Bernie Federko and Doug Gilmore was on that team, and anyways, it was exciting for us, you know, just squeaking into the playoffs and then beating one of the best teams in the league.
Has the NHL, Russ, always been, in all the years you've played and watching it these days? And I know you're still a fan, of course, of it. Was there always good parity in the league, Russ, or was it unbalanced at any point in your career? Was it, when you looked at it, going, these teams going into the year, you know, back in your day, going, these guys got no shot. They got no fucking shot. And you think that's the case that it is now? I don't feel that now, but you're the barometer here.
So when in the 80s and 90s, absolutely, until there was a salary cap, there was only two or three teams that were going to win, and in the 80s it was one or two, and it was tough because you just knew, you know, Edmonton was going to win or the Islanders were going to win, and of course there was a couple upsets. I think Montreal winning in 86 was a bit of an upset, and then in 89 it wasn't an upset, it was us and the two best teams in the league were Montreal, that the team I played on, in Calgary Flames, and we ended up in the finals.
Right.
But
right.
Now, if you make the playoffs, you have a chance. And that is so exciting for the fans, for the players. Can you imagine now making the playoffs and then you know you have a shot and you get hot, you can win. And the teams are all so good that make the playoffs that, you know, if the 16th team point wise wins the Stanley Cup, nobody's going to be surprised.
Right.
So it's great for the fans, great for the players, and awesome for the game.
You, when you bring that up, I remember when I came to Edmonton in the heyday from Ontario in 1985, you know, with Molson, who was a sponsor,
And I got this transfer here, my first full-time job, and I'm like, is this any good? Going to watch the Oilers.
No shit.
And the guy handed me season tickets, and Stevie Eisenman, who I know from Ottawa, and knew him from then. Detroit was playing Edmonton. And when you answer that question about, yeah, it was really lopsided, and it was 100% shot. I remember seeing him downstairs after, or maybe the start of the first game was that night or something. I was over there doing something, and I ran into him, and I said, "Hey, Stevie," and he goes, "Hey, Jimmy, how are you?" He goes, "Well, we're gonna try our fucking best."
Yeah, exactly.
It was like, yeah, he wasn't saying they're gonna lose, but it was like,
yeah,
this is we're gonna get slaughtered, you know.
Well, and you could say that to the media too. Like we're gonna go out, play our best, and hopefully win. I mean, it was so obvious that you did not have a chance,
right? And not good, right? As you say, not good for the league. And so you say it's the salary cap, Russ, for sure, that's changed all that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as the salary cap came in, the teams, there was more parity in the league, and you couldn't buy a Stanley Cup. You know, even with all the money in the world, it was still tough, but without a salary cap. But now you have to manage that team, and the GMs today, you talked about, you know, GMs today.
Right.
They have the mad scientist math magician that's, you know, keeping track of the salary cap. And then, oh, shoot, we've maxed out. And then this player comes out of nowhere, or they might have known, like, this is a good player. And then he's lights out, and then they can't afford to sign him. Or they have to trade somebody or try to trade somebody, or they just can't sign him. And it takes a lot of forward thinking, like in the future, like if this guy does this, and then they have a decision to make. And remember Chicago winning their cups, and then as soon as they won the cups, they were trading really good players, and Bowman was just trying to, you know, keep his premier players, but his, call them the B players, but they're still really freaking good. He was trading them right after the season, and he was just managing what was going to be a problem down the road, because these players were going to have to be paid accordingly. And he got back, you know, draft picks or players, and he made some good trades, and then he made some shitty trades, because, you know, that's part of the game. It's like drafting kids. You don't know.
Luck.
When you draft an 18-year-old kid, you just don't know if he's, you know what he's like at 18. You don't know what he's going to be like at 22 or 23. You hope that he's going to be great, but some people peak, and then it's tough.
Yeah, so it's this whole business side now, right,
of
this thing. And you talk about a very interesting thing, you know, that it's always a bit of a roll of the dice, even when you're working with salary cap, or you draft kids, or try and make a trade. You talk about Chicago, right, who just emptied their team out after they won their Stanley Cup, and the old fucking rebuild
cups
thing. When a team's looking at a kid, Russ, not so much the no-brainer, the Connor McDavids, the Austin Matthews, but when it comes time to draft a kid, you know, who's 18, young, 19, maybe only a year away, you know, that maybe you're going to draft him, zip him into the minors for a while. Do they interview these kids, Russ, ahead of time? Is there an opportunity to send someone out? Let's go talk to this kid to make sure he's sane, and see what he's like. We know what he's like skill-wise. He's showing all the right things. Is there a plan there, Russ, where they go, okay, we better go talk to this kid for an hour and see what's up?
Yeah, they interview the players. When I was rated to go in the first round, I interviewed with Washington Capitals, Toronto Maple Leafs, Vancouver Canucks, and one or two other teams, I can't remember. And I think at Washington, or no, it was Minnesota North Stars, had this like test. Yeah, and the guy read you the questions, and then. It was and then they sent it off to some psychologist or something like that. And at the end, like, I was so freaking nervous, right? I'm 18 years old. And I mean, I think at the time of the interview, I was 17, and I turned 18 right before the draft.
Right.
And, And at the end, he goes, thanks for doing this. Do you have any questions? And I said, well, I just hope that I...
pass the IQ test.
Well, he said, well, if you were honest, then, you have no problem kind of thing. It was like, I remember the remark, but I was just so flippin' nervous answering all these tests or questions. And then Toronto, I met with them a couple times. They flew me to, I flew over to Vancouver and I met with Dick Duff and Floyd. Oh, shoot. I can't remember his first name, but they were the two scouts for Toronto. And I met him in the airport in Vancouver, had like a quick meeting while they were flying somewhere. And then I flew back, had another one at in Montreal at the draft, and then talked to a couple other teams over the phone.
Well,
but it was nerve-wracking when, you know, you're just so excited about the draft and they're checking you out. For sure, they're doing their homework. And now it's easier with social media, with background checks. They can find out a lot about people, you know, good and bad.
Can you what did they ask you, Russ, in that interview?
They just wanted to meet you and see what kind of person you were. I mean, it really was just like having coffee with somebody. I mean, you sit there and obviously as a kid being, you know, just being super nervous, I tried my best, but they just wanted to talk and just hear from you, and just see what kind of person you were and if they could in a half hour meeting.
How nervous were you, Russ, your very first game? There, like, do you remember stepping on the ice for your first NHL game? And you know, I've heard from some guys that go, I mean, fuck, I could hardly hold my stick. My hands went numb, you know, and stuff like that.
Well, for me, it was different because I went and played in the 84 Olympics. After I got drafted, they sent me back to Victoria, and then I played in the 84 Olympics. And so I was on a world stage playing for a medal. And when I got called up, right after the Olympics, I played with the Leafs in Vancouver. Was my first game. I was still jet lagged from coming back from Sarajevo, and we went to France after the Olympics for a little tournament. And I just felt like I walked out, walked out on the ice, and I was excited. But I just come from the Olympics, and it was, to me, it was another game, my first game. But the first one in Toronto was when I was like, oh my God, I walked out on that ice, Maple Leaf Gardens, and that's when I was nervous. So that wasn't my first game. It was my first home game that I was really excited about.
What do you do, Russ, to handle nerves back in those days, in your playing days? I mean, I can't even relate, you know.
Yeah.
I was a competitive golfer when I was a junior stuff, and I remember being almost sick to my stomach, you know, playing in a what was my world, you know, a big event. And did you do anything?
I embraced pressure. I loved it. I mean, the more pressure, the better I felt. I loved it. So the only time I felt nervous, and it wasn't nerves, it was more expectations of winning the Stanley Cup in 1989. I was so excited to win, and then when I was on the ice, I felt really good. I felt in control, but I just kept imagining, you know, I'm gonna lift, you know, if we win, I get to lift the trophy. And I played well, and you know, I did my best, but I never had that, you know, where people get so nervous that it bothers them. It didn't bother me.
Right. That's another shiver moment for me when you just said, I might be able to lift the cup.
Right.
You know,
I was crazy. Two wins away.
Yeah.
And I couldn't sleep. Like at night, I could not sleep. I was just so excited. Yeah. And I thought it was destiny because my brother Jeff had won the year before with Edmonton in 88.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, Courtnell's in the finals again in 89, and we're up 2-1, and then we lose game four, five, and six. But I just felt like, I really felt like we were going to win. We were, you know, before I talked about back then, there was, right. We were the two best teams in the league. They won the President's Trophy by 3, 4, or 5 points mm-hmm. over us. And we had, I think we had 118 or 120 points. I can't remember, but it was a big, you know, two great teams playing against each other with tons of veterans and some really, really good young rookies and guys who played in the league a couple of years that went on to become great players. So
who were the goalies? Was it Vernon?
It was Vernie. Yeah. So Mike Vernon and for Calgary and Patrick Waugh.
Oh.
Yeah. So we were, Patrick was 22 at the time. He had already won a cup in his rookie season.
Right.
So he'd been there before and they'd beat Calgary 3 years prior. So Calgary was out for blood.
Do you ever remember guys that you maybe had to pull aside who were so effed up from being nervous? Were you that they were like off their game?
No, because you're so focused on preparing yourself. Mark Messier was great because I wouldn't call it nerves so much as I lost my confidence because Colin Campbell was such a dick to me when I played in New York, and he would. He was taking away my confidence instead of building it up. And so Mess came over and he goes, hey, you're a freaking good player. We're on the bench. We're playing together in New York. And he just patted me on the pads and he goes, Russ, you're a really good player. Just go out and play. Just play. And
cool.
You know, maybe that, I guess, you know, maybe I'm contradicting myself a bit, but that coach was not helping me and I was putting so much pressure on myself, but
right.
But Mess was that guy and Gretz was the same. And Bob Gainey, when he played, when he was a player, he was a great captain. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those guys. And Larry Robinson was another guy, put his big arm around you, that big right. huge arm. Right. And he really, you know, looked out for his teammates and stuck up for his teammates.
A reminder, the Suspendables are engaged on Facebook. Your comments are welcome always.
It's all pumped up now, Rusty. Our Facebook page is great. Lots of people are hitting it. We appreciate that. We got our Shop Now button. People are starting to snap up our merch, Russ, for one reason or another. And we appreciate all of you doing that. And let me read Rusty a couple of shout outs here. We love to get Rusty, find the JB text okay. that you got. That's a great shout out.
Yeah, JB is an awesome guy that we met at you and I met at Gretzky's fantasy camp, and JB sends me a picture. He texted me yesterday and said he sent me a picture of a White Claw with a really nice cigar on top of it. In front of his land yacht. Do you know what a land yacht is?
The motorhome.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
So he's bought a land yacht.
I'd love that, a land yacht.
He's got a outdoor, he's got this unbelievable TV on the outside. He's watching golf. And he goes, miss you, man. Thanks for doing the podcast. I feel like I stay in touch. And then he goes, here's a little picture. And then he thanks for getting me hooked on White Claws, you shit. So I was on our boat out in Lake Coeur d'Alene yesterday, and I sent him a picture of me, you know, drinking a White Claw, and I said we'd give him a shout out, but we miss JB and hope he and his family are doing great.
Right, we've got some interest in the show, you know, and we're out doing our road show. For sponsors, if we can't get White Claw somehow, some way, yeah. bunch of people like the Suspendables page and are listening to the show. As Carl Slack, hello Carl, and Barbara Brown and Chris Berry. I'm reading names here off our people who like us, Russ. Those are the best names. Shuttler, J.R. Shuttler, and Steve McNaughton and Stuart Postlewaite. I love that name. And a bunch of others, Janice Bramhill and
nice.
it looks like Darcy Coulter.
Who knew?
Who knew? Yeah, Corey Stagg and a bunch of other people. So thanks a lot, everyone, to listening for that. And again, you can follow us at The Suspendables, our Facebook page, or you can drop us an email at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. So, Rusty, the playoffs are going to roll out here, like I said. You gave us a little idea of what it's like going into playoffs. You surprised me with your answer that actually you do have to change your strategy when you're doing that. What do you think now, Russ, is going to happen? And, did you play in the day, first of all, Russ, did you play in the day, and I want you to explain it, did you play in the day of the trap?
Oh, my God, yeah, I played Montreal, and they...
So what is the trap, first of all, Russ? Explain.
It was one forechecker in, two forwards back, and 2D behind them. And then what you did was your first forward would hopefully direct the puck carrier to the wall, the boards, and then they were stuck. They were trapped. And they'd have to pass through the other two forwards and the other two D-men. So we moved in unison. And we would pick off passes all the time, and it actually, when I played Montreal with Guy Carboneau and Mike McPhee, we did it so well that we scored, the three of us on the defensive line, we would score 70 to 75 goals combined.
Jesus.
A year, because we're playing against the best offensive line on the other team, and they would try to make these what you call a dangerous pass, and one of us would pick it off, and then we'd turn it into an offensive opportunity. Mm-hmm. But Montreal, Jacques Lemaire, I believe was the inventor of the trap. Mm-hmm. When he coached in Montreal, he created that, and he taught and that Jersey. In New Jersey, yeah. And then other teams started adopting it. Like, they fought it for the longest time, and then coaches started adopting it. But yes, I played in the trap.
Yeah.
It took me a while to figure it out, but it took me about 10 to 15 games because you're...
Well, especially an offensive guy.
Yeah, just sitting back and waiting versus going on the offense to try to turn the puck over and create an offensive opportunity instead of waiting on your heels. Mm-hmm. And have them come to you was the hardest thing, was having to be patient.
Right. So now, Russ, if you're coaching one of these teams now going into the playoffs with this funky format, play-in round for eight teams, four in each conference, and then the five-game series. I'll throw some shit at you, Russ, and tell me if what you're going to do. Are you sitting the team down and going, okay, we got to be super defensive? Are you saying, no, not that, pour it on, take a bunch of chances? You talked about the trap. What would you do, Russ, going into this now with considering everything? 4 month break, team's got to be rusty, short series.
I think you coach the team you have. You play the cards that you're dealt. And so whatever your team strengths are, that's what you emphasize, and you just, that's how you play. If you're offensive, then you go for offense, and if you're struggling on offense, you try to play as the best defensive game you can. And but you just have to coach the team that you have in front of you and let them excel. So right. It just depends what team and who they're playing against, and let them be the best they can be.
Right.
Pretty fucking simple, Jim.
Well, I was wondering if you had more shutdown guys and shit like that when it comes to playoffs.
So if you're playing blackjack and you get a ace 10,
yeah,
it's not blackjack 11. Or 11. Do you fucking hit the 11? I don't think so.
Are you practicing the guys hard, Rusty, if you do it?
The players today are so fit, and I think the biggest thing is just getting the rust off and getting them as they're ready. They just need reps of, you know, drills and just getting used to touching the puck again, passing, shooting, all that stuff, just getting the rust off because of the break. And I've said this before that, you know, the young team, I think, is going to have an advantage because they're just going to come out freaking flying. And right. they all should be healthy. A lot of guys had months to heal up. Mm-hmm. And so it could be, you know, hopefully it's super exciting. And I think, you know, I don't know what it's going to be like with no fans in the crowd, but we'll see.
I see the biggest risk or the biggest chance or the biggest cross your fingers situation, Russ, in a league now where, you know, multiple teams are going with the two goalie deal, right? Mm-hmm. In these short series, you know, even in the round robin, in these five gamers, like, okay, who do we fucking start here in goal?
Well, I think that they're gonna start their best goalies, and then if they're not on their game, then they're gonna quickly switch because you just don't have time. You know, if the goalie's not on his game, they're gonna be like going with the backup,
right? Yeah, a little quicker than normal. Speaking of practices, Russ, in all your career, who you've had a bunch of coaches. Who ran the toughest practice? Who was mean?
John Brophy ran a brutal practice. I played for him in Toronto, and he would skate the crap out of us. And then we would think that the practice was over, and it was only halfway done. So he was really, really tough and old school. No water bottles, you know, he'd smash all the water bottles. You guys are soft. He'd smash all the water bottles so we couldn't take a water break. Yeah, he ran a brutal, long, long practice.
Down and backs and all that shit?
Oh, God. And pregame skates were a freaking full-on practice. The other team, so pregame skates are supposed to be about 20 minutes.
Yeah. A little walk in the park, right?
Or we'd be in Toronto, and the other teams we'd still be skating with the Zamboni coming around, and they'd be coming on the ice, and they're laughing, going, we're going to kick their freaking ass. Look how tired they are. And we're doing up and back. Yeah, John ran a stupid long practice and hard.
What would a guy like that do, Russ, if a guy, so he's got the hard practice, everyone's going to kick ass. What would he do if a guy was slacking?
Oh, he'd freaking two-hand him in the back of the, like he would come up behind somebody and two-hand him in the back of the legs or the ass or whatever. Yeah, he was tough. Tough. Prof was funny as hell. Like he was a character. He was, you know, it wasn't like he was real almost. He was so brutal.
Animated, huh?
Oh yeah, he was brutal. But a lot of funny stories about John.
But you probably learned a lot from the guy like that.
No, I didn't learn shit from him. He was awful. Yeah, I didn't learn shit from him.
That and the whole Coley Campbell experience sounded like nothing was good about that.
Well, I mean, you have good coaches and bad coaches. I mean, Colin Campbell was trying to draw something up before we played New Jersey, and Mark Messier stood up on the whiteboard and just kind of took over and said, so is this what you're trying to tell us? And we're like, dude, this, and that. Okay, meeting's over.
Mess, yeah.
Yeah, Mess was awesome. So what are you trying to tell us? Coley's been in the executive office for a long, probably 22 years now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, if he was a great coach, somebody would have been, you know, trying to hire him.
Right.
and you know what? Not everybody's a good coach. My brother Jeff is a great coach, and right. I'm average. Like I'm a good assistant. Like I'm a teacher, but I don't need to run the whole practice. And I would rather be in the background helping guys out individually. And I was on the ice with my brother with kids, and it's so easy for him. And for me, it was work. It was hard leading the parade of kids, you know, on the ice and drills and all that stuff, but it was just so natural for him, and he was great at it. And I was better on the, you know, as an assistant.
Yeah.
And I admit that, you know, and not every hockey player every hockey player that plays professionally or at any other sport, it doesn't mean you're going to be a great coach.
Right. Well, speaking of taking chances, you know, when you draft kids, I mean, it's as big as an unknown sometimes when you're hiring a head coach.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. A head coach, they've had success somewhere, whether it's in the minors or juniors or college. So you're not hiring, you're not like, you know, show hands who wants to coach the Toronto Maple Leafs. I mean, you're picking somebody who's been really tough. Successful.
Right.
I mean, right. But whether they're going to be successful at that level, that's another question. And we've all seen that college junior coaches come up with high praise, yeah. And then they can't coach at that level because they can't relate. It's totally different at the professional level because guys are making a shitload of money and they have a lot of power in the media. And if you get on the wrong side of a great player, you're going to have a tough time because, yeah. And vice versa too. If you get a coach who, you know, has success and he doesn't like a certain player, he can use that power against that player. So it goes both ways.
What's the word on the, of course, it was a huge deal and everyone was firing up the parade in Toronto when they signed that massive deal with Mike Babcock, what, 50 mil or something over five or 10 million a year, yeah. Something like that. And everyone's going, here we go. And what was the story in that guy, Russ? I mean, it didn't work out. He's not there anymore.
Yeah.
What was the word on that? Because he was going to be the guru of that team.
You know, well, I mean, look at, they won. They started winning with him. And I've just heard he's tough. I've heard, you know, Chris Chelios and him, he do not let you see eye to eye and other players. And that's somewhat normal with coaches. Not every coach is going to have somebody who does not like them. And I've had them where I like this guy and another player goes, I don't like him. Like, it just, every team, you're going to have players that do not like the coach. And, you know, when he got fired, a lot of guys started coming out, past players that played for him in the past that are now retired, and they said some pretty shitty things.
Right.
And it's tough being a coach because you know, I think Barry Trotz has done it really well. I've heard nothing but great things about Barry Trotz. There's a couple coaches where players really, really like them. And then there's other coaches that are hard asses and you hear shitty things about them. But I think that's, if you're going to coach or be an executive in the NHL, you're going to have
a tough gig, eh, Russ?
Yeah. You're going to upset somebody. You're going to trade a guy who didn't want to be traded. You're going to sit a guy who doesn't want to be sat. You're going to play a player on the wrong line and then he gets traded and he's going to blame the coach. And then you get players that, you know, they were nowhere and they were freaking never going to make it. And they get a coach that loves them and then plays the shit out of them to the point where they end up, you know, oh, wow, this guy's not bad. And then has a 10-year career or 15-year career because somebody believed in him. So it's a tough gig. You're not going to please everybody.
Chelly would have played for him in Detroit, I guess.
Yeah.
So he would be the barometer. Although Chelly may be a tough guy to coach, was he?
No, Chelly. I played with Chelly for 2 years in Montreal before he got traded, and coaches love Chelly. I mean, he freaking played hard every night, and he was a great teammate. And I mean, most coaches just loved him. And so maybe when towards the end of his career, when he started slowing down a bit and the coach didn't want him playing as much, you know, that's tough on anyone. I went through it with Larry Robinson. We were freaking super close as teammates. And as a coach, I was at the end of my career, he was coaching me and he sat me out a few times and I was freaking pissed. Like I did not obviously like that. I didn't agree with him. I thought I should be on the power play. He wouldn't put me on the power play. And so, but you know what? After my career, I got over it. And Larry and I are, whenever I see him, it's just like when we were teammates and Larry's right. A great guy. And I know he's a nice person. It's the coach that you think isn't a good person. That's tough to get over.
Right.
But Larry was such a nice guy. I mean, he's just a wonderful
great
human
guy.
Being.
Great guy.
And he had hard decisions to make. He made the decisions that he thought were right for his team. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it was against me, but there are coaches that make decisions hoping that they can screw you over. And Larry wasn't that guy. And so Larry and I are fine.
Before we go, Rusty, guys would occasionally, I'm sure not happen very often, but would end up missing a practice, missing a bus,
missing
the plane.
Yeah.
I don't know, did anyone ever miss a game?
No, I don't. Yeah. I never heard of a player missing a game. Not on my team. The funniest one for me was Brian Scrudlin. We're in Montreal, and his brother was in town, and I think it was Grey Cup. Yeah. And Saskatchewan Rough Riders or somebody, I don't know, his team was maybe won the Grey Cup. Mm-hmm. And they got absolutely shit canned. And he showed up 21 minutes into practice, and he came out on the ice, and he was still freaking hammered. And Pat Burns goes, okay, calls us in, and Scrooge's like bobbling, and he goes, okay, practice is over. And it was great because Burnsy was protecting Scrooge.
Yeah.
And that was freaking funny. And I thought Pat really handled it well. So if guys are late, you have to be at practice at a certain time. Like you're late if you're, call it 30 minutes before practice or 1 hour, you're late. So the occasional guy will sleep in and he gets there, but he's got a chance to get on the ice.
Right. Sneak under the radar.
Yeah. But as long as you're, you walk in the room, you got to be in the room at a certain time, and then it's like a player's fine, but you got to be on the ice. If it's a 10 a.m. practice, you got to be on at 10 a.m. or 10:01, you get fine.
Okay.
So if you show up late, the first thing everybody does is they cut your freaking skate laces.
Oh, no.
And they cut them just so you can't see them. So you're like, you rip your street clothes off. You get in, you're getting dressed. You put in, your skates are up above your head hanging to dry. So you reach up above your head. You pull down the skate. I always put my left skate on. You put your left skate on. You go to pull the laces and they're freaking cut. Now you got to freaking put new laces in your skates, and that takes minutes, not seconds.
Hours. Yeah, right.
And the boys are leaving the locker room all dressed, going out on the ice. So when it happened to me, I would go out with I would just tie up the top lace, and right. I could go out and skate with my laces cut, and it pissed everybody off. So I would tie them up and I would go out on the ice. And I would skate around so the coach saw that I was on time. And then I'd go to the bench and go, hey, to one of the trainers, I need laces. But I got to tell you that I'm at Gosser, and I couldn't play golf today, but I went out and I grabbed a cigar, and I'm following. We have these two times, 10-10 and 10-20. And it's Brendan Morrow and Ray Whitney, our two best golfers at the club.
They got the standard time?
Yeah, 10-10, 10-20 every morning. And now they got Coach Sean Payton playing in the group. They got Michael Whalen's new member. They got Mossimo. They got John On.
Sounds like a big action game.
Oh, yeah. Pat, the bat, Burrell, the baseball players it. Cully Chase was playing. So I grabbed the cigar and I went out and I found them. And I'm following around and I enjoy that. I don't have to play, so I'm following around. So on about the 15th hole, I said, guys, I gotta leave. And Mossimo says, why do you have to leave? And I go, well, I got this podcast. And he goes, really? And I go, yeah. He goes, well, I'll start listening. And I said, I might mention your name. He goes, oh, don't mention my name. And he goes, you can mention my name, because he's been in the media lots lately.
Yeah.
And so he and his wife, Lori Loughlin. So.
Oh, yeah, the college scandal.
So he goes, what do you guys talk about? And I said, well, I do this show with Jim Jerome, one of Wayne Gretzky's best friends. And he knows the Sherwood. He was a member at Sherwood Country
Club. I met him there. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the first time I met him was years and years ago when Lori had the still was doing the show Full House.
Full House, right. Yep.
So he talked about Sherwood, and I said, you know, I live on the 13th hole. So remember way back when I was telling the story about the geese?
Yes.
On 13th. So
you said never bring it up again.
Yeah, well, we're bringing it up.
Good.
So
fabulous.
So
give us the story again.
Okay, so the story is, so I live on the 13th hole at Sherwood.
Yes.
And during the COVID lockdown, they would send us emails like, you can walk the course, you know, you can run the course. And,
right.
You know, and people started like walking the cart pass. Then they're in the middle of the fairway. Now they got dogs. They got kids. They're freaking riding bikes around. I mean, it turned into a freaking park.
Right.
But when I'm at my house at 5 o'clock, having a glass of wine, looking over 11, 12, 13, geese start landing on the course. And I text the agronomist, Neil Edwards, and I say, hey, Neil, you know, there's geese on these holes, you know, turn on the sprinklers and scare the geese off. Well, there was this one night where there's three adults on the green, didn't know who they were, and their kids were, and their dog was running through a 45-yard bunker. And I went, this is not right. And so I think they're trespassers, and I freaking tell Neil, you know, there's geese on 13. So sprinkler comes on, they get wet, and they leave the green. It's really funny. Like,
totally.
I'm laughing my ass off. It's funny, but, you know, the kids were in the bunker, so the adults got wet and they left. So Wayne Gretzky is at a dinner party a week later, and he goes, he had heard Neil had played the podcast and said, right. Wayne, you gotta hear it.
It's our buddy Weeds.
Yeah. Weeds is saying, you really gotta listen to this. This is funny. So Wayne Gretzky's at a dinner party, and he's with fellow members, all friends of mine. Mm-hmm. And he's going, you guys got to hear this story. It's funny. And so Wayne is telling the story in front of about five couples.
Right.
How Russ and Weeds turned on the sprinkler and these trespassers, you know, ended up getting wet and left. And the guy at the end of the table has got this look on his face like, and Wayne's going, what, you don't think it's funny? He goes, no, because it was me.
Oh, no, of course. Oh, my God. Yes.
So I ended up, he complained, the person complained, and I got a freaking letter for it.
Right, right.
And I felt horrible that it was somebody that I knew, but I thought with all the emails to the members, there was no way a member would be lying on the freaking green drinking rosé and having their kids and dog run through the bunkers. I seriously thought it was a trespasser, and it turned out it was someone I knew, and I was like, right. Oh, no.
So let me just cut in for a sec. So then all that happened, and you were talking about it because we did it on the show, and then you got this letter, and you thought you were going to get suspended. And then you even volunteered a suspension. You said, if you have to, go ahead.
Yeah.
And then you said to me, don't talk about this anymore.
Yeah.
So now something's changed.
No, nothing's changed. No, nothing's changed. It's just a couple months later, and I felt like I could tell the story. But
right, okay, go ahead. Okay.
But I had, Massimo wanted to know, you know, what's the show about? So I had to give him something that would maybe get him listening, and he freaking laughed his ass off. Yeah. He goes, that is so funny. And I said, but Moss, I seriously didn't think it was a member. I thought it was somebody who snuck onto the golf course and was having a freaking picnic on the green.
Sure, sure.
And anyways, turned out somebody we knew. And
That's called, because you named your event after this, but that is truly goes down as a Cortinel classic.
Oh, right, yeah. There.
And we invite you folks to listen. Great show today, Rusty. Great. To listen to all our shows. If you want to hear, speaking of practical jokes, of course, you probably learned everything that you did. And you're one of the greatest practical pranksters I've ever known, next to your brother.
Oh,
next
yeah, Jeff.
Your brother, Jeff.
Yeah.
Check out the interview we did with Jeff and what he did with his, if you haven't heard the show, what he did with his neighbor's Christmas decoration.
Oh, my God.
It's the best ever. Rusty, probably a three White Claw show today?
Yeah, it was. And I might have had I might have had two before on the golf course.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah.
You've probably been behaving yourself because your wife and kids have been in town, so it's time to bust loose. It's time to let go.
Yeah, okay? It's time to lock myself in my room for 2 days.
Anyway, thanks everyone for listening again, and we're back each and every week on the Suspendables. Check us out on our Facebook page at the Suspendables, and drop us an email, suspendables@yahoo.com. For more antics and more stories, we'll be back next week with that and a lot more. Thanks a lot, everyone. Rusty, you carry on. Get out there. Get that wine cellar full. Something.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll talk to you later, brother.
Thanks, pal.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Cortinel in LA. A new episode every Tuesday morning on Wooshka, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.